The Velvet Podcast. Literature, genre fiction,
horror, sci-fi,
neo-noir,
speculative,
writing, films, music, and probably a few dick jokes. And now, recorded via the magic of the internet, please welcome this episode's host.
My name is Richard Thomas. My debut novel was Transubstantiated.
I'm Gordon Hyland, the author of Major Inversions. I go by Flash.
I'm Caleb J. Ross, author of Stranger Worlds.
I am Gavin Tate. My novel, The Way to Get Here, was published in 2006.
Welcome to, I don't even know what episode number this is, of the Velvet Podcast. Today we're going to talk a little bit about editing. It's a process that a lot of writers hate, a lot of writers love. I tend to fall into the latter category, so that's good for me. And we want to talk a little bit about what authors go through when they edit. What kind of strategies specifically do they use to edit? There's not a single way to edit. The ultimate goal is the same. We want to get to a final, polished, perfect piece of work, but getting there varies quite a bit. So how do you define editing? I guess for the sake of this discussion, let's just say that editing falls into two categories, basically. There's revising, which is when you take chunks of your manuscript and you move your manuscript around and you sort of play with the pieces themselves to see where they fit and how they flow. Then there's copy editing, which is a line-by-line type of thing. You want to make sure your I's are dotted, your T's are crossed. Let's touch on strategies. What do you guys, talk a little bit about your editing strategy. What do you do? How do you go about it?
I'm definitely not one of those kinds of guys who edits as I write. That's just way too painful for me. If I slow down to stop each sentence and each word choice and to make it perfect and to polish it, I probably would never write more than a sentence a day. I mean, you could say that maybe you'd be a better writer that way. Everything's really polished as you go. But for me, when I'm writing, I need to get it all out in one big stream of consciousness for as long as I can go. Sometimes that's, you know, writing a paragraph, sometimes it's writing 500 words, sometimes it's, you know, spending a day in this out-of-body experience, you know, call it going under or whatever.
Some people call that a zero draft, just knocking it out as fast as you can. It's not even like draft one, it's like draft zero.
Right. But for me, if I'm in the zone and I'm channeling my story, if I'm close to it, and usually I think on my stories a bit before I get writing, then when the time comes and I have this, you know, I know I'm going to write a story that's based on the short story, a song by the Violent Femmes. I want to base it on this 10-point structure, you know, and if I have an idea, then I would go into it, you know, it's okay, here's what I'm going to do, bang it out.
I'm really interested to know what your reaction is from people who read your work, your beta readers or your first readers. What kind of questions and concerns that they point out on those first drafts, as opposed to drafts that they might later see that have gone through maybe a couple rounds of editing and revising?
I try not to show my work to people when it's too raw. So even when I say I get that beta version out, that the first great crap, you know, just get it out there. I might step away for 5 minutes. I may step away for a day. I'm usually pretty impatient. So I'll come back and I'll revise it again. And then maybe I'll, you know, push some things around. But if I've gotten it right the first time, pretty close, I'll put it aside, then maybe a couple days later come back to it, and then I'll show it to somebody. Even if it's considered somewhat of a rough draft, you know, especially on big, it's different with novels than it is with short stories. Now you write a short story, here's 1,000 words, I think it's pretty close. What do you think? Did I screw anything up? Does it not make sense? You know, if I lose 5 people and they go, oh, I thought there were 2 girls at the end, then I've made a mistake. I need to go back and really change that. If I have 1 or 2 people that kind of disagree on things, then I'll look at it, you know, and try and figure out, well, who should I listen to and should I follow my own instincts? A novel is a lot more painful, you know. Usually I'm looking for either confirmation on what I'm doing right or looking for major mistakes. And if they catch typos and stuff, that's great too. But really it's a second, third, fourth set of eyes. And I just want to know, how's the story? If I screwed up really bad, what did I do?
You know, you have a really unique request a lot of times when we're going through workshopping, which would fall into the revising section, and that you do like to hear solely positive feedback. And that's something that's very interesting to me. So I definitely want to touch on that a little bit later, but I want to hear from Gavin a little bit too about how do you go about editing and is it an enjoyable thing for you? Is it a terrible thing for you?
Well, I think what Richard said, two things what he said. One was he initially said that if you edit too fast, it can be painful. And I think there is a painful part about it. I think editing can become this pit you get into, and then you're in there and you think you're doing this important because you're reconstructing what you've just done, and then you come back out of the pit and the landscape's all changed. Next thing you know, you're burning what you've made. And I think that's a really dangerous place to be, and I found myself there many times over the years, especially now. The other distinction you made I thought was really important is between short stories and novels. You know, I've gotten to the point with short stories that, you know, I blow, kind of what you're saying, I blow right through it. If I don't get the whole short story out in one shot, I usually will trash it and maybe come back and cannibalize pieces of it later, and then it turns into something else. But I really try not to edit a short story until I'm finished. But the novel I've been working on here for longer than I want to admit, you know, it's one of those things where you write up to a certain point and you're like, well, I always feel like I need to go back and cross some T's and dot some I's. The next thing you know, I'm back in that pit again. And for me, it's something I actually can enjoy too much. It can very often become very self-indulgent, that I find myself obsessed with the sounds of sentences and the shapes of paragraphs and how beautiful that verb really looks, when then I can lose the big picture. And so, I really like what Richard was saying about just, you know, if I can lay it all out and keep in mind that what I'm trying to do is get this big picture thing, and then I can do the little stuff later. However, I don't really think I can separate those things completely for myself. And so as far as strategies, I think I have to – I've been working on a novel mostly. So my strategies is mostly to give myself a certain amount of the book I'm trying to get through at one certain point, and then say, okay, at this point I can stop. I can go back if I need to, or I can go on vacation, or there's a Little League tournament, right? I mean, there's these other things that come in where I think sometimes editing is all you might have the time to do. You were talking about going under Richard, which is a wonderful thing to do when you have that ability, right? But if you don't, then what are you doing as far as writing? And sometimes I think editing is something you can do in those downtimes.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think part of my fear is what yours is, Gavin, that I'm afraid that if I leave it for too long, I'm going to forget what I was doing. And I'm afraid if I dig too deep into what I'm doing at the moment and mess around with it, then I'm just going to fuck it up and I'm going to lose where I was going. And then I'm just going to, you know, the whole story is going to be screwed up.
Yeah, and it's so easy to take something that actually is probably decent, you know, something that has a lot of potential. And if you tweak it before it's finished or before it's ready, you can convince yourself very quickly that it's a pile of shit. I mean, at least I can, you know.
So. Yeah, let your readers tell you that it's a pile of shit, right? Don't do that yourself.
Well, and I think it's interesting, though. I mean, I think it really, a lot of it comes down to what you're doing with your writing. I mean, I try really hard to focus on plot, but I think my natural inclination is very plotless. I mean, I had to fight really hard with The Way to Get Here to have a plot. I think when the book ended, it was very plot-driven, but my natural instinct is to just try to write really pretty sentences that do fun things. And
sure.
For me, that's a really, I think, masturbatory, you know, pitfall that I have to fight all the time. And, you know, and I think that for me feeds back into the editing is that I can spend all kinds of times on a paragraph making that paragraph seem as beautiful as I can make it, only to look up and everything around that paragraph doesn't make any sense. And so I think it is important to keep that perspective. And at least as far as teaching goes, not what I teach, but I remember being taught this idea that editing is, you know, I remember Chris Baer saying something at Naropa about how, you know, he got all this, you know, fame for his going under and going into hotel rooms. And mm-hmm. But he made a real point at the first summer I was there of saying, you know, 90% of what I do is, you know, is not that, you know, it's 10% is going into the hotel room and 90% is rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. But I think the rewriting itself, for me, can be problematic that you lose your instincts and you doubt yourself, right, and you lose your intuition, and I think you have to hold on to that because you can rewrite yourself into hell, in my opinion.
I totally agree. I mean, I've heard somebody say that, you know, a good writer writes and a great writer edits. I mean, I know what Caleb, you wanted to talk a little bit about the MFA stuff, but that's one of the things I've gotten out of my program is to really tear apart some stories. I mean, my professor down there talked about desk drawer revisions where you would take a story, put it in a desk drawer, and then rewrite it. And then refer to it only if, you know, if you had to. And I'm like, well, fuck, that's crazy. I mean, I'm
going to write
a whole other story. You know, I will never get that in, you know, I'm going to lose it. No, I can't do it.
We're talking a lot about various strategies for once we have the words laid down. You know, Gavin and Richard, you're talking a lot about basically kind of getting the words out there on paper, letting it go when you have the thought, and not turning away from it unless your house is on fire kind of thing. And can you tell us a little bit about kind of what you do?
Yeah, when it comes to the revisions and the editorial and the copy editing and all that, I have a very specific process that we can talk about later if you want to get into that. Like, I have specific things that I do in each pass. But as far as the what people would call the first draft, which I would consider probably more like a third draft for myself for most average folks, but I do so much advanced planning before I write word one that a lot of the things that people catch in the revision process are things that I've already thought through. So on each of the two novels that I've worked on, I've spent about 3 months on each of them before I ever wrote word one, just outlining things. I write like very in-depth character dossiers, and I will cast the characters with known actors. I don't tell people who those are, but I will base their appearance, not their mannerisms, but their appearances and stuff like that on specific people. So it's real easy for me to stay consistent as I go. And I have pictures of them like up on my, in little floating window palettes and stuff like that. Same thing with timelines. I'm obsessive about the timeline. The novel I'm working on right now is it's non-linear, and it's these two converging parallel narratives that jump all over the place. They're both linear, but they start at different times and back up and stuff. But I have to have that stuff down, dates and all that before I I feel like I'm wasting a lot of time when I'm drafting. So I don't really have, and a lot of people are this way, not just myself, I don't really have alpha readers. You talk about alpha readers and beta readers. I feel like if I'm in a workshop like Write Club, I have to make everything as polished as possible before I present it even to them, because I don't want to have to deal with that whole, yeah, I was going to do that, I just haven't got to it yet. Because a lot of the things that people would bring up are things that, you know, I would agree with. So the feedback that I tend to get tends to be very excellent because I've already polished it, you know, as much as possible. And when it does come time, when I get the first draft done, I feel I have enough objectivity because there's enough time and distance from the first chapter to the 30th chapter that my perspective is fresh again, so I can be objective about that. Somebody said, I think it was Stephen King, that said you should write your first draft with the door open and the second one with the door closed. I think it's really cool. It's not really what I do, but it makes sense for someone, especially if you do the zero drafting or whatnot. It just as a metaphor for, you know, being open to anything and everything versus being very focused and brutal and ruthless.
Can I ask you a question, Gordon? I mean, I'm curious. So you're really, I mean, you're talking very detailed outlines before you get started. I mean, are we talking down to chapter, paragraph levels or?
I use an app called Scrivener, and I haven't always, but even before that, I did the same thing, which is basically I have digital note cards for each chapter. So every chapter is a document, and every document has a note card that has what I would call a synopsis. And I don't write a lot in there. It's like I will jot down like the three major plot threads that happen there, and then in a little notes window, I'll write down some of the things that people talk about from a dramatic standpoint, like what the character's motivations are and what this person wants from the other person and what the obstacle is, some of that kind of status play type thing. I'll jot down a few of those things, and I just make sure I hit those beats. And I already have most of those planned out before I start. And one of the great things about that, and it's not for everybody, but one of the great things about that is it gives me the luxury of being able to write non-linearly. If I'm stuck, I can jump around and go to something else because I've already got that chapter with a little bit of an outline. That's been a problem when I was in a critique group like Write Club, which I'm not in this year. I've been working on this novel. This is my third year. And I spent 2 years in there, and now this third year I'm trying to get more traction going, and I'm able to write non-linearly, and I didn't really let myself do that before because I felt like I had an obligation to my readers to have things make sense. You know, I don't want to give them chapter 16 after chapter 10 because it'll lose them. But now I'm opening myself up to more of that, and I'm more productive on a daily basis because I can write whatever's interesting to me.
Speaking specifically to Scrivener, how does that work as far as line edits? Does that particular piece of software have functions and the ability to do line edits, or is it something that you basically have to, you know, print off the draft and go at it that way?
Yeah, this is really cool. It's something that I've only started getting into because I haven't done the second draft of my book yet, but I've done some things with short stories doing this, and it has this cool thing called snapshots. And the way to equate that is like people who do audio mixing, you know, with the big desk there. If they have if they think of a song as being in movements or sequences, sometimes the mixer needs to be arranged like all the horns are up and the drums are down or whatever. There's like these states. So the chorus is one set of mixes and you know the verses are another set. And this is kind of like that. You take a snapshot of a document or an entire book or chapter by chapter, and it saves that. And then you make your revisions and you save that one as a snapshot, which is a copy of that. And you can compare those two. It's similar to what Word does with like track changes or whatever, which I absolutely hate. But what it does is every time you add something, it will, if when you compare them anyway, it will show that in an underline in a different color, like blue. And every time you delete something, it will show that as a strike through in another color, like red. So at any point, you can roll back those changes. If you made a mistake, said, oh, you know, I shouldn't have added that section, it was better before, you can just roll back that change between those two snapshotted documents. You can compare them in a split window at the same time without having to jockey back and forth between those.
That's something that's missing from a lot of software. You know, Gordon and I have a back and forth where I actually really enjoy Word and I enjoy pretty much everything it does. And one of the things that is missing is that versioning capabilities, at least from what I understand. If anyone's listening out there and can correct me on that, please do. But the ability to, without consciously thinking about it, save a draft before you go on to a new draft without having to actually save a draft, a new draft every time. I know like Matt Bell, when I interviewed him for the Velvet Podcast a few months ago, he had mentioned that every single time he opens up a document, he's basically saving a new version. Like he will say physically save a new version. And so by the time he gets through with the story, he might have 30 or 40 different files that are actually pertaining to that one story just to be on the safe.
So what you're saying is there's another way to do it? Because that's what I do as well.
Yeah, I always did like V1, V2, V3, and I had like five different Word docs, and I hated that because they're not talking to each other. They're separate.
Right.
You know, I'd have two windows open and maybe copy and paste between them, and it was just brutal.
Yeah, that's what I still do. I mean, I'm looking at the background on my desktop right now has all the versions of my novel, and they all have different dates under them, so, which doesn't do any good after you've been doing that for, you know, a year and a half. But
we've been talking a little bit about how to get that original draft down. Now let's touch on a little bit of the strategies that we use when we are actually going after the second draft. We've talked a little bit about them, about what those strategies can be. You know, Gordon has talked about Scrivener and how he uses that, how basically that software has a lot of those editing tools in there. Gavin, you've mentioned how you get the first draft down and then you go in and you don't like to bury yourself with too much fine editing right at the beginning.
Well, I will say I should probably clarify that my problem is that I do bury myself with all that fine editing, and I think it's something that I'm trying to, I don't know if it's trying to fix, but it's kind of a constant tension. My instinct is to get in there, but I feel like what Richard was saying is more where I want to be, which is to kind of, let some things go and keep working. So.
Does it ever happen where you're just very upset that you spent so much time on that because really it amounted to nothing?
Well, that happens pretty much all the time.
We've got the kind of first draft. We're looking at the second draft, and we want to go more into not necessarily the flowing, but actually maybe get into some of the copy editing type of issues. And are there any specific strategies that you have about that?
I mean, I think copy editing is what I think that's where what one of my strengths are personally. Again, more than kind of the big picture stuff. And I heard, I think actually it was Matt Bell said somewhere in the last couple of weeks on somewhere on the internet, but he had a great line, which I actually wrote down and put up in my room, where he said something like, fix the sound, fix the sentence, fix the scene, which I thought was cleverly written, but also just it made a lot of sense that when you get into the copy editing and you're trying to figure out what's wrong with a word, not what's wrong. I mean, if you don't know what's wrong with the comma, I think you got all kinds of problems ahead of you. What's wrong with the language? What's wrong with the rhythm of the sentence? What's wrong with the rhythm of the paragraph or long paragraphs versus short paragraphs? I mean, I think that is the kind of stuff you can't really take for granted, because that's what creates, you know, you talk about drawing a reader in, you think it's all about character and it's all about scene and it's all about plot. But I think most of us know it's also about a voice, and a voice that, you know, knows when to go big and knows when to go small and knows how to like hold your attention. And that comes so much down to the individual rhythms of the sentences themselves. So for me, there's a lot of concentration on that. You know, something as simple as ending a sentence the wrong way for me can like blow an entire paragraph. It may have described the scene well, and it might have been the word I needed to picture something, but it's not the word that fits all the other words that are there. And so it might be something as simple as just pulling out a thesaurus, but it might be something more complicated than that, like going back and changing some other words and changing some syntax to get the paragraph to sound in a way that doesn't hem the reader up as he goes. And so a lot of my editing on the copy level is that.
Do you read out loud to find a lot of those voice issues or those rhythm issues?
I do. I used to read out loud all the time, but then I always thought I was deceiving myself because I could change my own intonation to make myself sound really smart. You know, and some of this came from teaching, which was I had to teach a poetry class a few years ago, and I'm not a poet, but I had to teach just a kind of appreciation of poetry. So I had to teach a whole section on meter, which meant I had to go relearn meter, like iambics and all those things. And it was really, really informative to me. So now I kind of, that's what I look at. I look at the meter. I count it, you know, and I count beats and I count stresses and unstresses. And I try to do it more in my head because I do think I'll lie to myself if I do it out loud a lot of times.
Gavin is my man, that meter stuff and rhythm. That's so important and that's awesome.
Yeah, I love that poetry angle. I used to write poetry too. And if I'm reading a sentence and it just feels awkward, I try and say it in a different way so that it the flow is right. And so the words bounce around right. And you might be saying the same thing.
No, and I think it is important to be able to, you know, I had a thing when I published a story. It was actually in the collages. Matt asked me why I had, like, this word in one of the last lines, and the only excuse I could give him was, I need that line to have 16 beats, because if it has 17, I'm not going to be able to deal with it. Oh, wow. You know, he was cool with that, so that was cool with me.
Do you have OCD, do you think?
You know, what's weird is that I don't, though, and it's only, I think it's only with syllables. I mean, if you saw my bookshelf, you'd go insane. You can't find anything.
Do you organize it in that way, too?
What, my bookshelf by rhythm? Yeah. Yeah. Whatever, I just throw them up there and whatever it sounds like.
That's awesome.
Could I interject something real quick here, Caleb?
Yeah.
We're talking about second drafts, and when I look at stories, when I try and come back at them for a second draft, I try to come at them from the reader's point of view. I try and push it away for a little bit, and you know, like some of us said, I think Gavin said that, you know, you'll come back to something, or actually it's Gordon talking about you've worked your way through a whole book, so by the time you get back to the first chapter, you've almost forgotten what you did. I try and give myself some distance, and whether it's an hour or a day or whatever it is, when I come back and read that second draft, I'm trying to just listen and enjoy it as a reader, so that when I am in that moment, you know, and I have a tiny bit of me that's still the writer and the editor up, you know, floating around in the ether there. So as a reader, I'm trying to just go through it and go, what am I feeling? What am I thinking? Can I picture the apartment? You know, do I have enough details in there so I can see it? Am I filling in the gaps with what, however I did the setting, so I can, enough of it's there. So as a reader, I'm making it my own. I'm bringing my own experience to whatever that apartment's going to be. Does it make sense? You know, so by the time I get to the end of the story, I go, huh, was that a good ride? Did I enjoy it? Did I, you know, did I see the ending coming? You know, even how did I feel at the end? You know, that kind of stuff. So when I go through my second time, I try not to think of it as Richard the writer. I try and think of it as a total stranger reading this for the first time.
Well, can I ask you a question, Richard? I mean, because I've heard a lot of writers say that. You know, I'm completely envious because I have such a hard time, even when I tell my students the exact same thing you just said. I'm like, if you can't do this, you can't be a writer. And then I go home and I can't do it at all. So I'm curious. I mean, is there anything you do to get yourself in that mindset besides just, you know, a certain amount of, you know, frankly, willpower that apparently I lack?
For you, Gavin, it may be that you're too close to it. If you're on top of it and you're thinking all these things, you're thinking about, I mean, fucking iambic pentameter and stuff. You're looking at the, I mean, and I try and write lyric stuff too. I'm cognizant of it. I think maybe for you, Gavin, it's just a matter of needing to give it a little more time. Maybe you just need to step away from it a little longer so you forget it, and then try and come back at it and just read it for fun. Don't read it. Don't pick apart a typo, a sentence, nothing. Just read it and experience it, and then when you get to the end of it, how did it make you feel? If you get to the end of your story and you go, "Well, I feel a little nauseous." Okay, now let me stop for a minute. Richard, were you trying to make people nauseous? I was, so it's a success.
One idea that might be worth trying out, and it's something I've tried myself, but I personally don't have much success with it, is that I record a story, audio version of a story, and then listen to it when I'm not near paper, when I don't have a pen in my hand.
That's good.
Kind of hear how it sounds from a completely objective standpoint. And again, it doesn't work for me. I tend to fall asleep a lot of times when I'm listening to any sort of narrative, but that could be something worth trying out. And, you know, these sorts of tricks are things that I'd like to touch on a little bit too. I have a few myself, and I was wondering if anyone else did as well. And I will, I'll throw out a few of the ones that, and these are hard and fast, very actionable ways that people can address editing when on their manuscript. And these are primarily line by line style edits. But a few of the things I do, one is I will change the font on the screen. So if I've been typing in Times New Roman this whole time, I've written it in Times New Roman, a simple change to something like an Impact font will make things jump out that just simply were hidden before. You get sort of dull and your mind goes a little, it gets a little drained when you're looking at the same thing all the time. So a simple change like that has worked wonders for me in finding things.
That's a good one. I like that. I used to write in Times New Roman, and then sometimes I'd write in Courier, but then for a long time I wrote in Minion, which is like a Times, but it's sharp. The serif points are sharp, so it's a little more aggressive, a little more angry, and it just kind of helped me to stay in a point of view where I wanted to be a little more aggressive with it. You know what I mean?
On edge, the physical act of looking at your words on the page affects the tone that you're writing.
Yeah, I look at Courier, and it has a whole different feel. It feels very dry to me, very, you know, official, kind of sterile.
19th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Totally. So changing the font for not only editing, but also during the drafting and writing process as well. I like it. Another thing I do is I will read the work from back to front, not really reading it in terms of trying to understand the words themselves, are not trying to understand the narrative or anything, but just it forces you to pay attention to each word. So things like a double instance of a word, or a double space, or just weird things that you've glossed over 100 times before will just immediately pop out. It takes takes quite a bit of motivation to get through an entire novel that way, but it's definitely worth it.
That would be a copy editing thing.
Exactly. Right, yeah, now. And these tips are really, for me, they're more about copy editing than drafting or anything like that. And yeah, I do mean not just sentence by sentence, but word by word. I mean literally going word by word all the way back. And it's just it's things pop out. It's unbelievable how much that works. Something else that I do, and this is what I do, and I think a couple of you other guys do this as well, is when I'm ready, when I think the manuscript is absolutely perfect and I've done all these other weird tricks, and one of the things I do is I print the manuscript out in as close to a final bound book format as I can. And this is one of the reasons I love Lulu, probably really the only reason I love Lulu, is they do allow you to print off single copies at cost, basically. So for $5, I can get a copy of my novel, and it looks pretty similar to what a reader might look at. And seeing it in a bound format, seeing it final, and seeing it in a format that has to be presented forces you to take an even closer look at everything about that work. It's no longer throwaway. It's permanent now.
No, I think I didn't even know you could do that. I mean, I remember when I got the proofs for my novel, I almost had a coronary. I was like, this isn't my book. I mean, it was 200 and something pages, and then all of a sudden it was 182, and there were too many words on all the pages, but it changed the way I read it, you know, which really pissed off my editor, because then I made a bunch of changes.
That's what they're good for.
It's something they talk about in screenwriting a lot, and it applies to fiction, I think, even more, is the appearance of the words on the page, how important that is. And some of that goes to rhythm. Some of it is to keep your paragraphs, in a reasonable length and to vary things up. But the actual experience of seeing, and I think that's where that's important, seeing it on the page, the way the reader will, might affect your approach to it. Talking about second draft revision process, I have a kind of a specific thing that I go through, and it usually doesn't take me very long, like I said, because most of the structural stuff is in fairly good shape, but I do have a process, and kind of like what some of you guys were saying, is I do go through and I read the entire thing all in one day, just as a reader, try to enjoy it, making no edits, but I will make, after each chapter, I'll jot down a few notes just that I want to keep in mind, some of the big sweeping things, just things to revisit later. I've got a little panel for document notes and for entire project notes. So I'll do that. And sometimes as I'm writing, I'll make notes over there as well for things that I don't know yet that I need to remember to revisit once I learn what something's name is going to be or when something happens or whatever. But my first pass that I do, usually do like three passes. And the first one, again, like you guys were saying, especially Gavin, is the consistency of the voice for all the characters, because even though I do a lot of outlining and charactering, that's still the voice for me usually does evolve some over time, almost imperceptibly. And so one thing I'll do is massage the narrator voice so it's more consistent. Same thing with character voices and actual dialogue. I try to make them even more distinct than they were the first time, because by now I've realized who everyone is, and I know everyone's arc, and so I'll make all of those things more distinct, and I do read all the dialogue aloud, which I don't usually do when I'm drafting the first time. I find myself simplifying instead of expanding usually when I edit, because I'm, you know, because I like to edit as I go. I'm a little too in love with the words, and I get a little too grandiloquent sometimes, so I'll eliminate some redundancies and simplify some of the verbs that are maybe a little too literary or whatever. One of the biggest things, the most obvious things that people would see in the difference in my drafts, I tend to shorten up my sections a lot more and move them around. So when I'm writing a scene, it's not that I think the scene is too long usually. I try to do that last one of the party, first one to leave, like most people do. But sometimes I'll put the entire scene in there without breaking it. So when I go through to edit, I like to maybe cut that in half, new section break, and then cross cut to one of the subplots, and then paste that back in afterwards just for more tension. So you get to a spot and then you cut away and then you come back to it. And instead of doing it at the end of a chapter, doing it at the end of a section. That's the kind of stuff I'd usually do all in one pass, the consistency of the voice and all those things. Then I'll do another pass for mechanical stuff, the grammar, the agreement, the spelling. I try not to rely on the spell check or grammar check too much. And I do a lot of find/replace. So a lot of those are for specific, I'll do one for each character to make sure I didn't spell their names wrong. A lot of proper terms or any terms that are unique to my novel, like the one I'm working on now, this guy has this ability like to read people or whatever. And so sometimes early in the book, I'd referred to it as reading or doing a session. But later on, I developed this word called biocasting, and I use that a lot. And I want to go back through and find all the instances of reading or session and sometimes replace those with this word that I came up with. Things like ellipses and dash consistencies and double spaces. I'll do find replaces on all of those to make sure I have the right amount of space on both sides of those. And one thing that that bugs me that I read in other people's work that I've been trying to catch in my own is the little apostrophe that you use in a contraction that's on the first letter of a word, like 80s or till. Right. In most word processors, those are backwards because they think that's a single quote. So I go through and I have to paste one of those in from a regular contraction like can't. And so I do that through the whole novel. God. You have to have an eye to do that. And then my third pass is like layout and formatting stuff to make the book look the way I want to look, because I'm probably going to be self-publishing. And, you know, replacing all the section break icons with something that jives with the theme of the book, and unindenting all the first lines of each section and stuff like that. So that's basically the process that I do. Usually it takes me a few months to do all that by the time the first draft is finished.
You're nuts.
I'd be really curious, though. I mean, do you find yourself as you're doing... I mean, I first agree with Richard, you're nuts, but do you find yourself, when you're doing that, seeing these whole other parts of your book? I mean, that is a microscopic way to go through.
I usually don't do, and maybe it's laziness, or maybe it's because I spent so much time the first time trying to get everything just right. I don't want to do a lot of rewriting, as you would say, or revisions. So I may be a little more dense and stubborn when it comes to some of those things. I don't want to make grand sweeping changes.
Yeah, don't make the change. I guess my fear would be doing that. I would just keep seeing little things here and there as I was trying to change an apostrophe. There'd be a word, two words earlier that, you know, I'd need to change.
Yeah. Usually because I do those three separate passes, I try to just focus on – you know, those a few things in each pass so that I don't get hung up on stuff like that. I did a workshop with Craig Clevenger a few years ago, and he sent out a rewrite checklist of these killer, just awesome, but they're super anal, like three times more than even what I'm saying. So I look at that. A lot of those are things I try to do on my first pass of the writing, but man, if you believe all the stuff he's got, he probably does like 10 editorial passes.
Oh, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'd love to find those and illegally post those somewhere under a pseudonym.
I do have them in a PDF, but I would not post them.
I'm going to post them under a pseudonym, and I'm going to use Gordon Highland as my pseudonym. So that's... Have any of you ever tried what I would call pseudonym workshopping? This is something I've tried before, not with you guys, so you don't have to worry about that. But basically, it's submitting a draft or submitting a version of a story without your name on it, with basically a stranger's name, so nobody knows who you are. And it's basically just submitting a story that doesn't have your name and people don't know who it's from. And when you get to know readers, I think a lot of times they can be friendly more than critical. And when you really want and need critical.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you know, Caleb, that's my experience every time I submit something.
People are like, who is this?
There's like, oh, look, it's someone we've never heard of.
the prejudice of the name. Yeah.
Right, it's true. And that carries over to, I think, a lot of established authors kind of bank on the name, you know, a name sells books when you get to a certain level. So, at the same time, a name can color the perception of how it's read, even when the only people reading it are a few people, but people you know very well. So I don't know if any of you tried this or what have been your experiences with feeling as though you're not getting honest feedback from people who you would consider friends.
Not specifically anonymously, but when I did an intensive class where we had a bunch of writer groups, I didn't know anyone in my group and they didn't know me. And the first few stories I submitted, I felt like I got more objective feedback because they didn't know me. And towards the end of the course, my fourth, fifth, sixth story, they were nicer to me because they, I think it was either because they knew me or because I'd established some certain stylistic things that they'd learned to live with and ignore because they knew it was stuff that I cared a lot about or whatever.
Right.
I think it's interesting you say it because I have my colleague, this great poet named Vivian Teeter. She, in all of her poetry classes, she makes students use pseudonyms, and you don't find out who the pseudonyms are till the end of the semester.
Where
I don't do that. I just say throw your stuff in there and we're just going to beat the hell out of each other. But I'm more and more seeing the wisdom in what she's doing, and it's, you know, and it's kind of what you're saying. It's not so much to protect people, but to get more honest feedback. I mean, people think it's to protect people's egos, but it's not. It's so you'll actually tell your friend what you think, and I think that's I think it's a really interesting approach.
I bet I would know a Richard Thomas story if I read one.
I have published one story online under a pseudonym. When Paul Eckert and I were launching Sideshow Fables, he was just getting the web part of that up. And he was having, you know, wasn't getting a whole lot of submissions, wasn't really happy with the work. And I'm like, oh, man, I want to get him something, but I, you know, I can't just give him a story as a co-editor. I've always kind of frowned on editors who publish their own work within their own, you know, magazines and stuff. I knew that Paul was looking for work at Sideshow Fables, so I created a pseudonym. I actually did my porn name. It took my middle name and then the street I grew up on. So my middle name is Gordon, and so the name I used was Gordon Hurst Green, which is actually a pretty good porn name. And so I sent him in, but I had to set up a whole new email account at AOL where I have my account. I know I'm a dinosaur, but I had to set it up because he knew my email, WickerCat. You know, so if I sent it in, he'd be like, Richard, what are you doing? So I sent it in, made up this name, tried to, you know, I said I had no bio, no publishing credits. I'm like, this is my first story. Here's my other email. I made a whole new email, sent it in to him. He liked it. He took it, published it, made some edits, and then it's been up there ever since. I finally told him, I think, like maybe a year ago that was me, but that was the only time I've ever done anything as a pseudonym. And I was really sweating it because I'm like, oh, man, Paul's just going to lay into me. He's going to hate it. He's going to really tell me how he feels, and I'll just be bummed. But it worked out. But it was interesting.
Was it still written in your same sort of trademark Richard Thomas type voice, or was it a departure for you stylistically?
No, it was kind of my same voice. It was a fun experience.
I want to kind of round out the discussion a little bit by asking, is it ever okay to revisit a published work? You know, published can be posted online, published can be published in print, and it's much easier these days, I think, than it has been in the past to have the ability to edit and republish a work. But does that make it okay?
I mean, I'll say that at least in the anthology that's coming out, the Velvet Anthology is a piece that I had published earlier with a website called Perigee that is no longer publishing, and it was a piece I really liked, but they locked down their site so nobody could read it. So Pila was good enough to let me put that in, and I went in and made changes, and then Pila went in and made changes that were great. So it was a really weird phenomenon for me. But
I've read that All the Acid in the World, is that the one?
Yeah,
I love that story. I've read five or six of the stories, and that was one of my favorites.
Thank you.
This is sort of the George Lucas question, isn't it? do you want to mess with your legacy? You know?
Yeah, so I'm just curious because all you guys do a lot of workshopping, and so I'm curious what you see as the value at this point in your writing of workshopping, because I do almost none. I mean, I teach it, and like, you know, I do it in classes with my students, but I pretty much don't workshop any of my own stuff until it goes, you know, out to an editor or I submit it. So I would just be really curious at this point, because all of you have published, what are you getting from the workshop experience?
The workshop experience for me, and the reason behind workshopping stories, is kind of the same reason why I tend to frown on self-publishing. In most cases, Gordon obviously excluded, but basically authors tend to be terrible readers of their own work, and I know I am absolutely a terrible reader of my own work. So I think it's necessary for other people to get a look at it, get a read through for it. Even if I never went through the formalities of a workshop session or finding a critique group, even if I just passed it along to one or two people and had them kind of give it a read, give me some honest feedback, that would be enough, I think.
Right.
But at this point, I'm just not confident enough in myself to do that, to be honest.
Well, and I would like to say, though, I think that's a really important distinction you just made, though. I mean, I think there's a big difference between, say, you sending your piece, be it a novel or a story, to one or two people. That's a very different phenomenon, I think, than the workshop model, which is you sitting down with 14 other people or 10 or whatever it is. I think it's a different kind of feedback. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah,
and
no, Rich, totally.
Richard, you're coming out in MFA, and I'm just curious what you think.
I found it's kind of the same in my MFA program, workshopping with, you know, 5 or 10 people, or in like Write Club where you have at least 4 people reading it. Sometimes you have more if they want to read it. But I think the biggest thing is that you have to learn to believe in yourself and trust what you're doing. I love being in Write Club and I love being part of my MFA program, but the people in my MFA program, they really didn't get my work. And if I listened to them, right, I never would have written Disintegration. So I had to tweak what I was doing in that program, and I wrote literary short stories. Now, I'm really proud of the work I did there. I mean, I worked with a Pulitzer-nominated professor, and even the story that he thought was, you know, terrible ended up getting published at Pair Noir and getting a Pushcart nomination. So, I mean, it really pushed me to work harder and to work more in an academic manner. And, you know, I revised in that program more than anything. These stories that just went into my thesis that I defend next week, I worked on some of these stories for 6 months, a year, where we went through 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 revisions on things that I never would have done on my own. Now, in Write Club, it's more like family. Now, not that, you know, I mean, you'll tell your brother if he's being a dick, right? You say, hey, you're being a dick. But you'll say it in a nice way, and then you'll give him a hug later. That's kind of how Write Club is for me. I don't want people to pull punches unless I ask them to. One of the things we talked about a little earlier was this whole idea of asking people not to critique my novel while I'm writing a rough draft. This is something I picked up from Max Berry when I did an intensive at The Cult, where it was his idea to do that, saying that just get the first draft done. It's hard enough to write, you know, 70,000 words over the course of whatever, a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year, without doubting yourself at every turn. But in Write Club, when I was writing my rough draft, I wanted people to tell me what I was doing right. I wanted them to propel me forward so I could finish this fucker. Once I was done, I said, okay, I'm done.
Gloves are off.
And we got it. Yeah. Well, but that's okay. Hopefully by that point, at least I already know the things they like.
Well, and you know, that's, I mean, when I did my MFA, I mean, I there's still one or two people from my MFA that I talk to, but I just think as someone who teaches undergraduate creative writing and that's supposedly based on this workshop model, and we're, you know, the workshop model is the model. And this is, I mean, I'm not, obviously, people have said this millions of times before me, but it a lot of times feels like kind of a focus group. It feels like your story is being, mm-hmm. it's all right. About like, well, the story has to do this, you know, and I imagine all the great stories and great books that would have never survived in a workshop, you know, because they didn't do what the story was supposed to do. But what Caleb is saying is kind of the route I take, which is I have, you know, I might have 4 people total in the world at this point that I allow to read my stuff. And so I was just curious, really, I was curious about your experience, Richard, because you're coming in, you know, basically about 10 years after me. And it sounds like it's pretty much about the same, where it's still the, you know, 10, 12 people, you sit around and, you know, people say, I didn't like this. And
it didn't matter who the person was. Like I had a woman who was 80 years old who wrote these really nice romantic short stories. But man, she would nail me on grammar. And I had somebody else who was like, you know, didn't like crime stories, but he liked, you know, Westerns. So like he would really help me with setting and stuff. And so I just found that there were certain people in my groups that I would pretty much ignore. You know,
right.
I mean, if they fixed things, typos, grammar, they didn't get it, I'd keep that in mind. But even when I had 5 people in a class and 4 of them said that at the end of the first page, they didn't know what was going on, I'm like, that's okay. You aren't supposed to know what's going on. At the end of the first episode of Lost, nobody knows what the hell's going on, okay? It's all right. Just, do you want to read more? What's the only question I have to ask? And if they didn't, then I have to also step back and think, well, is this really my audience? I know with the people in Write Club that a lot of them are my audience.
Absolutely.
Not everyone, but, you know, there definitely are people in there that I know are fans of my work, and I don't want them to blow smoke, but I know that if I do it right, different people will go, yes, this is it, bam, love it. And I go, okay, I'm good.
So Richard Thomas is J.J. Abrams. That's what we've learned today.
I have this thing that I don't like to. I have two sort of a divide here, and I don't know if I can articulate it or not. I don't like to workshop short stories, but I do like to workshop novels, and I think it's because of the stakes. So from a chapter to chapter, I need that consistency. Good. And like you said, there are different strengths. Like Bodensteiner was really good with structural things that he would notice that I wouldn't pick up on. Pele Villa would pick up on like how it made her feel and some technical things. Totally. The threads that I would lose, but with a short story, it's weird to me. It's almost like a song. I can deal with any mistakes that I make in the context of a short story, and I'm cool with that. It's like I don't want to let them in on that. And plus, at this stage of my cough career, if you want to call it that, a lot of the people who I'd be workshopping with might be my only audience for the story, that they might read it, and I don't want to, you know, it's anticlimactic. Yeah, you can read it in 3 months, you know, when it's done. Right.
You're going to lose a sale.
Yeah. So I don't know why that is exactly, but I don't like workshopping short stories.
Well, and it's funny you said that because the entire academic institution is all based around short stories. I mean, Rich probably knows there's a hell of a lot of resistance to come in to a creative writing class and say, I'm writing a novel, because no one knows how to deal with that. Because, we only got 4 weeks. You got to turn shit in. Yeah. And I'm trying personally to figure out ways to deal with those few students I have who want to do things differently, but still have them participate in what it is that gives them credit. You know.
Also, over the course of a novel, you notice these, kind of like I talked about with the intensive before in my group, you start noticing the consistencies. You get 4 or 5 chapters in, and people are like, oh, you know what, that's kind of his thing. He does that, and I'm recognizing that now. In a short story, it's just like, it is what it is. It's a slice of life or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, you made a good analogy there, Gordon, about calling a short story a single, whereas, you know, maybe a book is like an album, you know. You could play someone one song off the White Album, and they might not like it, but you play the whole album for them, and they go, oh, yeah, overall, I see what you're saying. Or they might, like, I just like this one song, you know.
I mean, I would care more about their opinion of the album than a particular song.
Right, but if they didn't like that song off the White Album, they're probably an asshole anyway.
Right. Well, I think that's a given.
Other voices, other rooms.
I'm currently reading Matt Bell's short story collection, How They Were Found, and I'm really enjoying it. Some pieces are excellent. Short story collections are always spotty. Some stories are better than others, but I'm really enjoying what I'm reading there. Before that, I read Fred Venturini's The Samaritan, which I absolutely loved, and I think most people who read the kind of authors that we do would like as well. You can find me at my homepage, gordonhyland.com.
I'm currently reading Ben Tanzer's newest novel called My Father's House. I don't think it comes out for a little while. I'm reading an ARC version. It's absolutely amazing so far. It's I've been a long fan of his, and this is probably the best thing that he's written, and he's written a lot. So look forward to it, everyone. It's great. It's from Main Street Rag, which is a small independent publisher on the East Coast, I believe. And you can find me at calebjross.com.
I just finished reading Cape Cod Noir. That's for Akashic Books. It's a really interesting collection. I don't know if you've read any of the Akashic Noir series. You would think, well, Cape Cod, what the hell is going on in Cape Cod that's noirish? But it's actually a really good collection. There's some great stories in there. I'm just starting Donald Ray Pollock's book, The Devil All the Time, and it's just, you know, it's just awesome. I'm so excited to finally get around to it, and it's just it's everything I hoped it would be, and I just can't wait to actually get back to reading it. And then I'm reading a couple books from Red Lemonade. It's a new press. One's called Zazen, and one's called Follow Me Down. Two slim books that I keep picking up and putting down. They're both really good. A whole range of different stuff to read there. But check out Red Lemonade. They're a new press. That's Richard Nash, who used to be – where did he used to be, Caleb? Richard Nash?
Soft Skull, I believe.
Soft Skull. Thank you. I couldn't think of it. You can find me at whatdoesnotkillme.com.
I'm about to start reading this book called Recipes for Endangered Species by Tracy O'Connor. That I'm supposed to do a book review on, so I've been kind of flipping through it, but I think I'm going to buckle down here in the next couple of days and read the whole thing. But it looks pretty fun. And I just got done reading Dave Foster Wallace's Pale King, which if you're a fan is fantastic. If you're not a fan, then I can suggest other books to read. I also just read Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman just on a whim, and that was like just more fun than you're supposed to have when you're reading a book. So and other than that, I'm just reading for my fall semester where I'm supposedly teaching a class on experimental literature. So just kind of going through a bunch of books that I need to read before my students do. And if you're looking for me online, you're probably not going to find me.
That's awesome.
All four of us happen to have stories of Velvet Warmed and Bound collection.
Oh, yeah. We should kind of plug that.